Griffith University is a Gold Coast institution and continues to grow. Its dynamic urban campus blending seamlessly into the region's world-class attractions. And now, partnering with the Gold Coast's cultural leader, Hotter Home of the Arts, we're proud to present our signature thought leadership and conversation series, helmed by master interviewer Kerry O'Brien. Welcome to A Better Future for All.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. My name is Carolyn Evans. I'm the Vice Chancellor and President of Griffith University. And along with our wonderful partner, Hotter, the Home of the Arts, here on the beautiful Gold Coast, we're delighted to present this series, A Better Future for All, tonight with David Williamson. Hotter and Griffith University recognise the traditional custodians of the lands on which we're situated, the Kumbumeri families of the Yugambeh language region. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and recognise their continuing connections to lands, waters and their extended community throughout southeast Queensland. Tonight, recognising in particular that storytelling has been an incredibly important part of this region for tens of thousands of years. Could I also acknowledge Ms. Rachel Hunter, PSM Director General of the Department of Premier and Cabinet, councillors of the City of Gold Coast, Corinna Gurkha, CEO of Hotter, and of course, Kerry O'Brien and David Williamson. Well, what a pleasure it is to welcome you here tonight for another chapter of our Better Future for All conversations, an ever-growing, captivating series chaired by leading journalist and author Kerry O'Brien. Now, in Australia, from the humblest suburban town halls to the most prestigious stages in our capital cities, our love affair of the theatre has been a key part of our cultural identity for decades. And if you don't believe that, you might want to read the book by my colleague Julian Merrick, which recently sets out a history of Australia in 50 plays. Theatre unites. It reflects and dissects our communities. It provides comfort, commentary and criticism alike. Those playwrights who see the extraordinary in the everyday and translate it into relatable, moving, challenging, humorous entertainment unquestionably have a rare and wonderful talent. In this, tonight's guest, David Williamson, AO, is in a league of his own. As Australia's most produced and prolific playwright, David has captivated audiences for over 50 years through renowned works such as Don's Party, The Club, The Removalists, Emerald City and many more. After celebrating five decades in the spotlight in 2020, David released his memoir, Home Truths, in 2021. This work commemorates his remarkable career and lifts the curtain on the unique trials he's faced as a fierce advocate for and a driving force in Australian theatre. Recognised at a national and international level, David was made an Officer of the Order of Australia almost 40 years ago. And since then, his accolades include the Helpman Award, J.C. Williams Lifetime Achievement Award, a New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards Special Achievement Award, and he's also an official National Living Treasure. David has won five Australian Film Institute Awards for Best Screenplay, including his original script for Gallipoli and the film adaptation of Don's Party. His career has taken him across the globe, with his work appearing in theatres in Britain, the United States, Canada, and a range of countries across Europe and Asia. It is most fortunate for us then that his work is bringing him here to the hottest stage to share with us his insights tonight. Please join with me in welcoming David and our host, Kerry O'Brien, to the stage. Please enjoy tonight's entertainment.
So, David, as your memoir confirms, your life and the lives and dramas of others around you have informed so many of your plays. Your compulsive curiosity about other people's lives, as you've put it yourself. I want to follow that thread through our conversation tonight, tapping first where that sense of drama and black comedy and at times pathos has sprung from, starting with family and the young David observing his parents, Elvie and Keith, endlessly fighting. His mother particularly, who he comes to see as full of bitterness and rage and hostility, particularly towards his father, but in her own cruel way, you say, she was often blackly funny. Very sad to think how that would impact on any child, but also a gift for a future writer, yeah?
Yes, Elvie was a piece of work. She did all the mothering things. I shouldn't be too critical. She brought us, my brother and I, up and gave us the best of attention. Well, qualify that a little. I think her attention was mainly on herself most of the time, but she was complex. She was one of those generation of women that had enormous inner energy and ambition, but nowhere to take it. Marriage was almost obligatory by the time a woman was 21 or so, and it remained that way for many years. And my father and mother were married at an early age, and her entrepreneurial zeal and her life force virtually for quite a while had nowhere to go. And so she wanted an audience, and my father was the only available audience. And so if there wasn't drama in the family, she would create it.
Yeah.
She would start an argument, and
Well, I think where you were leading is that getting your father to boiling point was the quickest way to engineer the drama that you believed in the end that she needed in her life. And I want you to tell the story about the night she goaded your dad until he exploded in rage.
Yes, my Peter and I were totally used to the fact that the bickering never stopped, initiated by my mother, but my father would fight back after a while, on this particular night, I think it was about 11 years old, Peter and I looked at each other. The bickering and the abuse got louder and louder, and finally my father exploded and got up from the table and said, "I can't stand this any longer," and stormed off. And my mother raced out into the laundry, and I thought this was the end of marriage moment. I thought tears were pouring down her eye, and I had divided loyalties. I thought I'd better duck out and comfort her. There she was in the toilet laughing her head off. And I suddenly realised that human social life was more complex than I thought it was. There was a subtext going on that I knew nothing about. And it was I was always curious. She didn't see me. I slunk away again. Years later, towards the end of her life, she always had some stiff brandies after dinner, and I said, "Mum, I've got to tell you this. When I was 11, I said, I described what I saw. I said, what was going on?" She said, it was so boring up the bush. I had to do something, but the sex was good afterwards.
The way you describe it in your memoir now gives a sense to some degree of a boy not so much caught up in it as observing it almost as an outsider.
Well, yes. Peter and I were the audience. We didn't participate. We just watched in horror. And I remember thinking, is this what all guys have? They have to get married and then you have to do that? And this is horrible. I think as a result, I've always tried to avoid conflict at a social level, but been acutely aware of it in social discourse. Because of my mother, I soon learned to pick up the subtext. I learned to pick up the aggressions that were barely disguised and some that were well disguised. But it's a playwright's business to look under the surface and find the real emotions which are charging the surface dialogue. And often there's a lot of frustration and aggression that's masked in daily dialogue. My mother taught me that. My mother taught me inadvertently that language was not just a medium of communication, it was a weapon. It was a weapon to gain revenge, to put down other people, to gain satisfaction, to gain prestige, even affection and love, although that wasn't highly in evidence.
Mm. John Updike wrote once that most of the best fiction is written out of early impressions taken in before the writer became conscious of himself as a writer. Does that resonate?
That does resonate, Kerry, because I was absorbing this complexity of language and its multi-purpose nature without even knowing I was doing it.
Mm. Yeah. Then decades later, after Elvie and Kevin had both gone, you wrote a play full of pain and pathos and black comedy called After the Ball. Here's an excerpt. Your mother is Kate and your dad is Ron. Kate, you don't know what's going on in the world, Ron. You sit reading your books, and when you're not doing that, you're out in your shed making useless furniture that nobody wants. Lucky I've got women friends or I'd go mad. Ron, I've never met a more intellectually stunted collection of misfits in my life. Sit through an evening of their conversation and you'd risk brain damage. Kate, at least they have a conversation. The only time your lips move is when you're reading. So, what was the sum of what you were saying of your parents and your childhood in After the Ball?
Well, it was basically, it was a mismatch of temperaments. My mother was extroverted. She wanted a party. She wanted life. She wanted social intercourse. My father was more an introvert who was happy fashioning his furniture that no one wanted or building his ham radios to speak to a Japanese in Tokyo who could only speak 10 words of English, but they were preferable to what he was going to hear from my mother. she had, a need for interaction, drama, and a need for achievement that she wasn't typical of the period. She had to go out and work, and she became a ferociously successful saleswoman in Myers in Melbourne, disguising her hostility when necessary and selling lots of stuff.
So post-school, you kind of wandered through university a little bit lost in an engineering faculty where the impression is you were constantly scratching your head as to how you got there. But I can understand why you might have been attracted to psychology when you committed yourself to doing your psych masters.
Yes. Okay,
so what did you gain from psychology at university about the human condition that you've spent the next 50 years applying to your plays?
Well, the engineering was a mistake because in the education system in the 50s when I was growing up in a country high school, boys who were good at maths automatically were pushed into science, medicine, engineering, science. Girls were pushed into the arts, whether they were good at science or whatever. So I ended up, even though I loved English, and we had an English teacher that brought Shakespeare to life, and I absolutely responded to that, I had no opportunity to do it. And I ended up doing the course with the least chemistry in, which was mechanical engineering. I had no interest in it whatsoever, but I finished it because my father said, you've got to have something to fall back on. But then I went back and, as you said, and did psychology, which I drifted towards social psychology, the science of trying to understand how people influence other people. And it gradually dawned on me what an intensely social species we are, that the opinions of other people are incredibly important to how we view ourselves. When we were in the evolutionary past, when we were in groups of 150 or so, to be banished from the tribe was a death sentence. So you had to learn to get on with other people, not necessarily your relatives. We are, as I say, it dawned on me how intensely social we are and how much we need the opinions and the friendships of others and how much we distort our behaviour to accommodate others, or how much guilt and shame we feel if we feel we haven't lived up to others' expectations. And so it was an eye-opener in a sense that this is what I'd been observing in my family life, and this was how we are as a species.
You'd started out wanting to write great novels, but you say that aspiration had collapsed. But then you had a light bulb moment. You saw a Melbourne Theatre Company production of Arthur Miller's play Incident at Vichy, which you say was your road to Damascus. You pivoted overnight from dejected aspiring novelist to playwright. You went home and, as you put it, dashed off your first play.
Yes.
Was it about the theatre that captured you that night?
Well, I always knew I wanted to write stories to explore human social behaviour, but novels were obviously not my métier, and I'd given up, but I'd been writing student reviews at Melbourne University and then Monash, and I loved the feeling that your words, your dialogue, was actually out of the mouths of actors, impinging on an audience, having an effect. So instinctively, I was a playwright, but didn't realise it until I was sitting in that theatre, and I was just drawn in by the intensity of the bond between that audience and the live actors on stage. They were telling a story that was meaning. It was about persecution of Jews during the in France during the war, and it was an intense piece, but you could feel the literal pin drop of the audience being totally engaged with what these very good actors, the story they were telling them. There was something entrancing about that live feeling in a theatre of live actors, live audience, actors telling a story that was literally impinging and perhaps changing people's lives. I thought, I'm not schizophrenic, but the voice in my head said, that's what you can do. That is what you should be doing. It was just a strong conviction that came over me.
Yeah. So as you were taking your first steps down the road through the experimental theatre groups like La Mama and then Pram Factory with plays like The Coming of Stork, The Removalists, Don's Party, what was happening in mainstream theatre in Australia?
It's hard for the young generation to realise how little of our stories ever hit our stages. The mainstream theatre, Melbourne Theatre Company and in Sydney, the old Tote, were doing a diet of, I'd say, 90% English plays, about 8% American, 2% European and virtually zilch Australian. Occasionally, some of the $17 pop-up then disappear. Then a decade later, one day of the year would pop up and then disappear. There was no continuity. And when I first expressed the thought that I wanted to write plays for the Australian stage and said it to a leading administrator of the Melbourne Theatre Company, they said, well, David, sorry, just nobody comes to Australian plays, because theatre was then, as our literature faculties were in universities, dominated by Englishmen. Our John Sumner in Sydney, the same. Everywhere, the English cultural influence was huge. F.R. Leavis was the god in the English faculties, and he taught that there were only five novelists worth reading, and four were English, and the other one was an American who was really English. And so we felt a sense of anger. I was told that there was no Australian drama because Australian life was so dull that there was nothing worth writing about. And when the Melbourne Theatre Company started up, John Sumner said his list of objectives were, number one, the subtext of what number one was saying is to uplift and educate the barbarous natives. He didn't express it that way, but that was the... And number 10 was to encourage Australian writing. So I knew, as a budding psychologist, that our social needs and social life was just as complex and just as demanding. The social dance we have to do is just as demanding in Australia as anywhere else in the world.
And so we need our own stories.
Yeah.
We need to hear and...
We
and
need our own accents. The Australian actors would go overseas, learn 43 different regional English accents and come back and do English plays. And so there was an anger in the small theatres around Carlton. Why are we barred from our own stages? Why can't we tell our own stories? And luckily, Betty Burstall came back from New York, saw the off Broadway La Mama, and realised that you won't get Australian writing unless you actively search for it, which she started to do, and which gave us an opportunity.
Now, I can't remember the exact circumstances, but but you recount, was it The Removalists, where an academic held it up in a lecture theatre and dropped it with contempt?
Yes, an F.R. Leavis disciple from the Midlands of English said, if this is Australian drama, we don't want any more of it, and dropped it in front of the class. Well, I had a rather heated argument when I heard that is that my mother's came out.
All her training. After the success of Stork, La Mama rejected your first draft of Don's Party as too middle class. The Melbourne Theatre Company said it wasn't middle class enough. But La Mama liked another play you'd just written called The Removalists. So while La Mama produced The Removalists with its explosion of male violence, the new Pram Factory around the corner in Carlton, started by Graham Blundell, who'd come across from La Mama, produced what you've described as the train wreck of Don's Party, and the two plays opened on the same night, and you were actually acting in one of them.
Yes.
How on earth did all that work?
Oh, well, it. When the Melbourne Theatre Company said, this play is so crude and vulgar, we can never put it in front of a civilised audience, and when Carlton said it was too civilised, it was too middle class, so I went away deliberately and wrote a play, the genesis of which I'd heard when I was helping the removers shift our furniture. It was cheaper if I was his assistant, and he told me about this great story that happened last Friday, and my eyes opened, and wow. So that became, and that was sufficiently working class for the guys at
for La Mama.
Yeah. It was actually a very dark comedy about the worst aspects of Australian male behaviour, but they interpreted it as a savage attack on police brutality. Kenny Carter, the guy that ended up dead, was just as bad as the two cops, but they didn't see that. And so Graham Blundell, who'd broken away and started his own mob, said, oh, they're putting on this play by Geica Williamson. There's been a play on my desk for a while by him. I better read it. And so he read Don's Party, and they were going through a dip in finance. He said, this could bring in an audience, but the APG actors hated it because it was very Brecht and working class. They were all thoroughly middle class university students, but they were making plays for the people in the house, the working class in the Housing Commission, and they didn't want
who
weren't coming. No, they weren't coming. Yeah. they didn't want this middle class trash. And so I sneaked around there to hear rehearsals with my now wife, Kristen, who was in the cast of Removalists with me. And I walked in the door, and there was one fiery actor saying, if they're that fucking unhappy, why don't they fucking get divorced? I thought, oh, my player's not exactly being greeted with open arms. But luckily, the audience loved it, and it saved their finances. And that's the only thing that saved me over the years from the cultural gatekeepers that control our arts, is the fact that audiences kept coming.
And within a few short years of those simultaneous opening nights, 40% of mainstream productions in Australia were being written by Australian playwrights.
Yes.
A reflection of the times, I guess, to a degree. Generational change, political upheavals, gender revolution, make love, not war, that whole kind of time. But nonetheless, you found yourself in the first wave of that.
Yes. Suddenly there was a transformation. A lot of it had to do with a new sense of nationalism that arose around the election of the Whitlam government. It was the time for Australia to shed the English cultural yoke and try and forge its own path. And there was a tremendous energy. Whitlam tripled the arts budget. Suddenly there were schools training Australian actors. There was a hunger for our stories. The novelty of hearing our own accents on our stage was just terrific. And the whole transformation happened. Suddenly the big theatre companies realised that far from being a drawback, to have Australian stories being told was a box office bonanza for them.
Now I'm going to come quickly back to the simultaneous opening nights. You watched the final scene in The Removalists on that opening night from the loft above the stage with an actress named Kristen Green, who was later to become your companion for life. Can you describe the moment when the play ended?
That was our first audience, so we didn't know. That's the magic thing about the theatre. You never know what you've got until you've got an audience, because that's what theatre is. It's the interaction between them and them. And there was a dead silence at the end of the play, like, boom. I thought, oh, my God, a total dud. And then, boom, they realised that something significant had happened that night.
And Kristen knew,
yeah. She was confident that that would happen. I was a nervous wreck. But I knew I'd made it when the titans of Faraday Street, John Rommel and Jack Hibbard, bounded up the stairs and shook my hand as if I'd suddenly become part of the Brotherhood. And that was, wow. I knew I was on my way.
You say in the memoir, quote, "It was the most profoundly satisfying moment I had ever known. I was instantly addicted, knowing right away I'd be pursuing these exhilarating moments for the rest of my life. But like a lot of addictions, the exhilaration of applause, the sweet glow of success is a two-edged sword when you become dependent, isn't it?"
It is. It is an addiction. People say, "Why do you write for the money, for the fame?" No, it's an addiction. You want to create something that is going to impact in the way that the Removalists did on that first night. And I had it again with Don's Party in Sydney, and quite a few of the other plays have been like that. And when it happens, it's magic. But you're right, it's a form of addiction, and it brought an excitement to my life. Can I do it again? Can I put the right words in the right order? Can I get that magic happening between a great cast and an audience so that I know something I've done as meaning something to them out there?
You say now that as your success grew, suddenly finding that in certain quarters you were scorned, derided, and in some cases hated was a psychic shock. And despite all the success, you suffered recurring panic attacks at one point. How did you deal with that? What did you learn about yourself in the process?
See, I'm congenitally a nice guy. I tend to like people.
Not always clear on the page.
No, well, I see people's faults, but I tend to like people. And my experience after graduation was teaching at Swinburne, teaching fluid mechanics and thermodynamics, of which I knew something but wasn't wildly interested. But I loved the experience of teaching. All the students I got on well with, all the staff I got on well with. It was nobody hated me in the world, and then suddenly my play started impinging, and half the world hates me, the ones that want to be playwrights and are not, and the ones that find my work not to their taste, and certain acerbic critics, and you suddenly you feel, there's another side. If I go into a foyer on opening night, half the audience will be really wanting to meet me, and the other half will be scowling in the corner. And it is a psychic shock. Yeah. It is a psychic shock to be envied, to be disliked for what you do, not for what you are. And it took a lot of adjusting to. Yeah, I hated opening nights in the foyer because I'm 6'8" and everybody could see me there, and they're going,
reading every nuance on your face. Yeah, I interviewed Edward Elby when he was 81, and he recalled opening night on Broadway for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf 47 years before. He said the long line at the box office was wonderful, as was the audience response, but he still remembered the critic who'd written a dirty-minded play that should only be seen by women of no taste.
Yeah. Well, I got a few of those. I got after The Removalist had a triumphant Sydney opening, a few of the critics, one of them I remember, said, "Blood for blood's sake," and stuff like that. You just,
I get the impression it's taken you a long time to be able to come to terms with that, to actually grow a skin thick enough to shrug it off.
Yeah, well, I think basically I'm a sensitive person partly because I always had to endure that early marital warfare, and I don't like conflict and I don't like bad vibes, and I am acutely sensitive to the subtext of a line. A person can say something like, "Oh, I really like that moment in the third scene where so-and-so," and you read, "Yeah, what you're telling me is that was the only moment in the play that worked and the rest was a load of shit." That same sensitivity allows me to read subtext in normal dialogue that are essential for me to construct plays, to really know what's going on. So if I was an insensitive person could brush off that sort of stuff, I don't think I'd be capable of the sensitivity of working out what's really going on underneath.
Mm. Last word on the critics. Catherine Brisbane, probably the leading Australian critic of her day, wrote after You've Got to Get On, Jack, which was your very first play, that you were the first Lumumba playwright to put characters on stage who were real and not stereotypes. And you say that line cemented your belief that real life and its nuances were the best sources of inspiration. So there you are, a critic who actually helped you on your way at a very critical stage. And I imagine, well, it's clear from your book anyway, that there were many times when you would take a point that a critic was making as valid.
Yeah. The first critic was always Kristen, who read the very first draft. And I was acutely sensitive to her verdict. She'd go up into her office and I'd wait tensely for 2 hours, and then she'd emerge from the office. If she had tears in her eyes, I'd know it was going to be a hit. If she had a frown on her face, I knew there's a lot more drafts to go. But yes, you do. And as a playwright, I would listen to the actors and the directors during the rehearsal period. And if they had misgivings about a scene, if they thought something was wrong with the structure, I'd listen to that and often rewrite. I'd do up to 15 drafts of a play. So yeah, take on board, don't be arrogant, take on board what they say, and it does help.
Yeah. You've had 56 plays produced in all, most of them reflecting the dramas and the conflicts in your own life and the lives of your friends. The Removalists, spawned by your own household, Removalists, Don's Party, an amalgam of two parties you'd been to, and various characters based on friends. Conflict within your university faculty as a lecturer became the department. Moving from Melbourne to Sydney, thus earning the disapproval of Melbourne friends, became travelling north. You're exposed to the excesses of the Australian film industry, that becomes celluloid heroes. Your wife, Kristen, becomes an investigative journalist in Sydney, and you write Sons of Cain. You buy a beach house north of Sydney, and the local community provides the source material for Money and Friends. We're talking about a lifetime of observing and participating in drama and conflict and comedy, of soaking it up like a sponge and interpreting it back to us. But how consciously were you moving through life looking for ideas for plays to write?
I can honestly say, Kerry, it was mainly in retrospect. I never sat down at a dinner table and took notes and said, oh, this is going to be a good one. No, I didn't do that. When I was searching back, I have a facility to remember the emotional flow of events, the undertows, the social interaction patterns. I can remember back months and months exactly what happened. I have no memory for detail, which is why I was never going to become a novelist, because I couldn't describe the room I grew up in or anything. I've got no memory for that, but I have got a memory for the social flow that I saw acting out before me. And on the other point, yes, that fact that Catherine Brisbane did say that, I put real people on stage, and I said to myself, that's because they are real people. That's the people I observed when I was doing vacation training in a very rough Tasmanian mining camp. Those are the characters. And from that moment on, I stopped. Some of my early plays were imitations of other writers, but from that moment on, I said, I am going to base my plays on my own observations of life, things I've experienced and things I've worked out. Mm. So I know they're accurate, because often writers say, well, I'd never resort to research, I'd never resort to writing things from life. I use my imagination, which is a code. Well, there's only two sources of information, is what you actually experience and know is true, and what other writers say about life. And often when writers say they're using their imagination, they're unconsciously drawing on the observations of other writers, and if you're doing that, the audience can identify the tropes, they know the patterns, they know where those other writers have been, and they know what you're doing.
So other writers have probably drawn on other writers.
Yes, on other writers. And so I thought, well, I'm going always for total verified source that I know happened, which limits the writing in one way.
Which you still play with.
Yeah.
You're still playing with the characters.
Yeah, yeah. I don't. Someone said, "Oh, Don's Party is just a tape recording of a party. That's all it is." Well, it's not. There's a lot of shaping. There's a lot of shifting characteristics between one character and another. You never put a real person actually on stage, but at least I know the events are real, the characteristics are real.
Because you say, truly original, in this same vein about the two sources for a writer, the truly original ideas are in fact as rare as blades of grass in a desert.
To come up with a truly original idea is, you call those people geniuses, and they're very few and far between. Mostly we draw on the work of artists who've gone before us. In fact, who was the famous writer who said, was it Picasso who said, good artists borrow, great artists steal. Well, I didn't want to steal.
Yeah. I'll just pluck out Money and Friends. You say the social approval of our friends is one of our most powerful emotional needs, which you put down to tribal instincts, and you referred to that earlier. To be ostracised by our group is one of the severest psychological punishments that can be inflicted. In Money and Friends, you posed the question, we would die to protect our children, how far would we go to help a friend? And in attempting to answer that question, you drew on this little clique of friends around your beach house community. So I just wonder how you answer that question for yourself, but how your interpretation of them in the process reflect how that impacted back on them.
Yeah, well, it was always a puzzle to me doing psychology. I could understand why we're ferociously committed to the welfare of our children and our close relatives, because they share our genes, so in helping them, we're sort of helping our genetic immortality. It really makes sense that family is important. But why friends? No genetic links whatsoever. And the answer actually didn't become clear in psychology itself until the 90s, when we suddenly realised that our evolutionary past was a tribal past, as I said, of about 150 people, and we had to learn to live fairly seamlessly with non-relatives. We had to value friendship, we had to be sensitive to their needs, or to be ostracised. If it's ever happened to you, you feel intense shame if you're caught, you feel intense guilt if you're not caught, to be ostracised was really a death sentence. And in modern society, it's still a very savage thing. If you find out that that your circle of friends is having a party and you're the only one not invited, you'll ruminate on that for days and days and say, what have I done? I came down to the fact that genetic ties are still much more powerful than friendship ties, but friendship is still vitally important, and that the question posed was, a dear friend through no fault of their own goes guarantor to his brother on a house loan, the brother's a bit shoddy, loses all his money, is in dire straits, he's going to lose his house, everything, do we all kick in the amount needed for him to go to court and try and get his money back? And the early answer was no. But then decency prevails in the end, torturously, but it does.
And how did your friends from Pearl Beach react to the depictions of them?
Well, by the time I wrote Money and Friends, I knew ethically if there was any sense that I was using real people as models, I had to show them the draft beforehand. I'd been doing that for quite a few years, so I did. There are a few grumbles, by and large, I thought I could be ostracised here. I could suffer the fate myself. But then they all went to opening night, and they're all waiting for me on the deck of our house up there with their Money and Friends T-shirts on. And I went, God.
I wonder how much we can rely on psychology and basic human instincts to explain the best and the worst in us. When someone displays great courage or self-sacrifice, do we just put it down to genetic predisposition or to our conditioning? That everything would be preordained? Can we never have pure altruism for altruism's sake?
Oh, look, I think there is. I think we all experience the distress cry of a baby and we feel it's immensely painful. We want to help that little thing. We want to stop its pain. Initially, it was genetic, centred on your own baby, but as we became tribal, I think it just generalised out. And if you hear another baby in distress at an airport or somewhere, your instinctive orientation is to go and try and help. If you see someone drowning in the water, it doesn't have to be your relative. You know, you think, oh God, they're going to die, they're suffering. And most people, if they're still capable, fit enough, will do something to rescue them. So I think there really is a sense that we most human beings, except sociopaths or psychopaths, which are only about 3% of the population, most people instinctively respond to distress calls, particularly those from those who are weaker and disadvantaged compared to us. I mean, the compassion we feel for injustice in distant parts of the world can be intense. We can feel enraged at what's happening in Ukraine at the moment. They're not our relatives, but they're human beings. They're close enough to us to make us really feel their pain and want to do something. Mm. I think there really is a fellow feeling amongst human beings, and we don't like to see other people suffering and in distress, particularly if they're less advantaged than we are. Mm.
But again, that question that you put in the play, how far are people prepared to go to actually go beyond the feeling? I was struck by how proactively you would seek out the right director for a particular play, how you would be prepared to open a new play in Brisbane or Adelaide rather than Sydney or Melbourne to get the right director. Like Rodney Fisher in Adelaide for A Handful of Friends or Aubrey Mallor in Brisbane for Brilliant Lies.
Yeah, good directors are gems, and part of their skill is the ability to attract and cast really good actors. And a playwright is only as good as the actors on stage and the director that directs them. So I learned very early on that it's counterproductive to get a bad production, because people will tend to blame the writer no matter what. They won't see that really it's been poorly directed and poorly acted. So avoiding bad productions became a necessity, a career necessity, I thought, yeah.
And if you struck it right with the right director, the right cast, and you got the right outcome in Brisbane or Adelaide or wherever, it was going to work anywhere. That was like that.
Yeah. It was like when Aubrey Mallor rang up and said, look, I've got John Gade and Robin Nevin contracted for next season. Do you think you might write a play for them? It was like like a football coach being asked, listen, I've got Buddy Franklin and well, I can't find the Robin Nevin character, but do you think you'd like them in your team? Oh, yes, I will. So that became Money and Friends. As soon as I knew I had those two, and Aubrey Mallor, one of the great directors, that set me on that course.
And I remember, because I actually was making a documentary around you at the time that you were making, that Celluloid Heroes was being prepared for stage, and you've subsequently acknowledged that it wasn't one of your better efforts. One of your rare
flops.
and you explain that you actually did you have to go overseas or
yes,
so you weren't there for the actual rehearsals.
The first time in my career I'd never been there during the rehearsal period to get the feedback of the students. The day after the first reading of the play, I had to get on a plane because Peter Weir was shooting Gallipoli and he wanted me over in Egypt.
Because you'd been working on the screenplay.
I'd been working on the screenplay, and there would inevitably be minor changes and changes that occurred because of what we found in Egypt. So I had to be there, and I missed the whole rehearsal process and came back. I would have picked up the vibes. John Bell was directing, and he told me he had misgivings as it went into the second act. and the cast had misgivings, but there wasn't email there at the time. There wasn't an easy way to contact me in Egypt, so they just had to live with it. And it taught me a lesson, never to go away again when your play's on, because I would have listened to them. The fault was because it was an attempt to... I won't go into it. You know,
file
you did
away.
The doco.
File it away. And I'm really interested in the comparisons you draw between your experiences with theatre and your experiences in making films. You had two great... successes and great experiences working with Peter Weir on Gallipoli and also Year of Living Dangerously, but Hollywood was a whole different story, wasn't it?
Yeah, Hollywood, they say, is a factory, and it is. It grinds out a product, some of it very good, some of it not so good.
You described it as a soul-destroying version of Groundhog Day.
Oh, yeah.
Over 14 years.
Yeah, I'd go over there, and in America, appearances are... even more vital than here in Australia. You've not only got to be a writer, you've got to look like a writer and act like a writer, and
whatever that means.
And whatever it is. But when I flew over to LA, I'd feel myself breaking out in a nervous rash on the flight by the time I got there, because you have to go into a room and face a whole team of execs that are usually Harvard law graduates that know nothing about story or anything, but they're bright. And the director and God knows who else. And I was doing studio films at those times, and these were mainly feel-good movies. Now the independent movies have much darker characters, but in those days it was all the producers who were usually horrible human beings.
So your bad luck was that you were writing dark films. I want you to tell me the one about the American captive based around... an American captive in North Korea in the Korean War who makes a propaganda tape under torture. Nicholson and Tom Cruise were going to be the actors.
Yes, I was the flavour of the moment. It was set in the Korean War, and the Chinese were starving. The American prisoners, they were dying of heat, of cold. Night after night, they'd die. And finally, they induced a lot of them to say... propaganda pieces to the camera, and that was they were traitors to the American warrior class. We have to make an example, so they picked this poor guy out, and we're going to put him in front of a firing squad, and the Nicholson character was playing the senior counsel defending him, and
Cruz
was playing the young advocate, and it was about the relationship between those two and the prisoner. And yeah, I was a stretch limousines, best hotels in Hollywood, and it got right up the chain. It was just about to be green-lighted, which is the magic moment in Hollywood, and the head of
Paramount,
Tartikoff, said, "When's this thing set?" And they said, "The Korean War." He said, "Oh, fuck," he said, "they've forgotten about the Iraq War, let alone the Korean War. No, can it?" But I like the situation, he said. I want you to find a story that's got Cruz and Nicholson in it. And that became A Few Good Men. But mine was suddenly the limo didn't turn up.
And you had to catch a taxi to the airport.
Had to the airport to slink home. When you're hot in Hollywood, you know you're hot. But when you're not, you know it even more instantly.
The experience of writing a script on the infamous First World War spy Mata Hari with director Robert Altman.
Altman was a fascinating guy. I really admired his films. Discontinuous narratives, or whatever they called them then, but he was great and a great person to talk to. But this producer who'd just become head of RKO, Revive Studio, didn't really know what he was doing and contracted Altman. Now, this was way down the list of Altman's priorities. He was doing his own movies, but he was getting a good development deal, so he went along with it and said, "Well, do what you can with it." And we had some good lunches. He showed Kristen and I his latest movie shortcuts, but there was no sense that it was ever going to be made, but it was a great experience.
But you still had to go through the motions.
Yeah, I got well paid. He got well paid. Mata Hari, I think, is still...
Wasn't part of the problem that she was bisexual?
Yes, yes. I decided to tell the truth, and I mean, she was set up by the French. She was sleeping with German military and French military simply because she was doing it for money. But that was a good scapegoat. They were going to shoot her because she slept with Germans. But the truth was she was bisexual, and I thought, I'll introduce this into the story. And it probably... Now, it probably would have worked like fury, but the studio was horrified. No, no.
You were invited to write another film, Savaging the Worst of the PR Industry, around a character who called himself Dr. Death, to be played by Dustin Hoffman. What happened there?
I got phone calls from... My family used to joke to me. They'd say, hey, it's your mate Dusty on the phone here. And I'd speak to... He loved the story because this guy was evil beyond belief, because he boasted, yes, I only act for governments that have killed 10 million of their own people. And he was the worst aspect of PR, and Dustin wanted to tell the story, and the studio said, no, this script, no, you've got to have redemption. He's got to have redemption in the end. And
I so you could start with Hitler and it would have worked as long as he was redeemed at the end. So and the groundhog aspect, the repetitive pattern between script being commissioned and then getting to a whole range of stages and then dying. I think you've said for every 40 scripts commissioned, only one is made in Hollywood.
Well, that was true of the time. They've tightened up a lot now, but there was a huge wastage in those days. Film is such a hit or miss thing that they were prepared to take a gamble on a lot of scripts being developed and then try and pick the eyes out of them. Yeah. Still, only one in seven was a box office bonanza, but Hollywood could live with that because the one in seven that was huge.
So I can understand when you say that the big difference for you between film and theatre that makes theatre so satisfying, you kind of lose control very quickly in Hollywood, don't you, as the writer?
Yeah, because...
Whereas as the writer in theatre, you are invested and respected virtually all the way through.
Yes,
right?
Yes. You know, they'll try and be faithful to your work in the theatre, which is not what happens in film. Ever since the French devised the auteur theory and decided the director was the author of films, the writers have been vital to the industry, but not recognised and treated as such. But yeah, it was painful because some of those scripts I was given were really good scripts. Like that Dr. Death script was as powerful as all get out. And Dustin finally walked when he was told we had to put redemption in the character. He screamed down the phone at me, "Fuck redemption! Just write it," but they can't. So yes, I had a lot of pain there. A lot of effort went into strong movies that were never made because they crossed the studio line.
But it did reduce your mortgage.
Yes, I was well paid for them.
So I want to come back to your plays now for the last part of the conversation. And another feature of the plays that you do acknowledge is the big thread of guilt and self-therapy that runs through a number of them. Dare I say more guilt than a church full of Catholics lining up for confession? Which I can say personally. In A Handful of Friends, ironically titled because you say it was more about cannibals than friends, you create a character called Russell based on yourself, who you describe as a mediocre academic with few, if any, redeeming features, based on yourself. Why so ruthless with yourself, and what was the guilt that drove it?
I thought if I was drawing from life, to be fair, if I was finding the foibles of other people, I had to be equally demanding about, as honest as I could be, about my own weaknesses. I did a lot of self-searching and said, well, it's only fair to reveal my weaknesses. It was a bit painful to write, and sometimes I exaggerated, to some extent, my faults, but... Yeah, it must have been some form of therapy because I wanted to feel I could be honest with myself. I hate self-promotion in its worst sense, and I didn't want to make any of the plays a vehicle for my glorification and the de-glorification of some of my friends.
There was a recurring guilt, wasn't there, that ran through
a number of your plays.
Yes, there was.
I'll say it. The guilt that drove plays like The Perfectionist that were as close to the bone as you can get for you and Kristen, your infidelities in real life and her responses, your 15 years of bad behaviour, as you call it. Did Kristen not protest at also being exposed to the public gaze in order to expiate your guilt?
Yes. I was within a thread of destroying what has been an enduring and very good marriage. And looking back, I find it hard to believe I did that, and I find it hard to believe that Kristen eventually forgave me, not without great pain on her part. So I'm just so glad after we've been together now 51 years, 15 of those years, I put her through stuff that in retrospect is unforgivable, and it didn't really make matters better for her to see me exorcising my guilt.
And did you feel any better about yourself when you saw a handful of friends performed on stage?
No, it was all I could say was, well, at least you've been honest about yourself, but it certainly wasn't a pleasant experience.
You actually asked Kristen once why she stayed with you. What was her answer?
She said, virtually, you know, I can see in the future someday you're going to get better. Someday the man I thought I fell in love with is going to be there. I was actually in frozen Denmark. I was doing a stint with the family as a visiting professor of drama, and I was in a dressing gown in a heated flat with a Danish winter outside playing the piano, and she looked at me and thought, that's what he's going to be one day. I don't know whether she meant a decrepit old guy in a...
in a dressing gown.
In a dressing gown.
Shivering.
Yeah.
Well, what she said, as recounted in the memoir, is her future hope for you, that you would finally be at peace with yourself, with what you are and what you have.
Yeah.
Which suggested a lot of, well, more than restlessness, demons.
Yeah, demons. I like to excuse myself that being abnormally tall in school, I wasn't exactly mobbed by young ladies, being a foot and a half taller than anyone else. So it was a pleasant shock when I got interest from other women that I found difficult to say no to for a while, and that was... But it's no excuse, really. There's no excuse for inflicting pain on my dear
but
wife.
Yeah, but the being at peace with yourself...
The peace with myself,
with what you are and what you have. So after all the decades of running, of often agonised self-searching and public excoriation, of heart attacks and of a stroke, have you found peace with yourself?
Oh, certainly, to the point where...
What does it feel like?
Well...
Tell me.
To the point where Kristen says, why don't you talk to me occasionally?
I can see your lips moving, but...
I have, and I feel very fortunate to have the family I've got, and feel extremely fortunate.